Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today on the show, I'm here live with Ivan Torres. He is a local scholar over at Eastern Washington University, and I asked a few people who I know and trust, I said, who can I talk to about Venezuela and how ridiculous the coverage of Venezuela is and the whole context, how it all fits into immigration, and they all said you. So,
well, welcome. Thank you for having me on the show, Taylor. Again, it's great to be here, and always a pleasure to talk about, you know, all these things that we're listening to and hearing, and actually delving into the details and the actual perspectives of other countries. So, yeah. I think it's important conversations to have.
Yeah. So, I guess just starting out, if you don't mind introducing yourself, talking a little bit about what you're studying, but also why, like what's, you know, driven your interest in.
Sure.
In what you're studying.
I'm an Eastern grad student at I did the history program at Eastern actually, and I really delved into history the more I got away from my country. Actually, I was actually born in Mexico originally, in Mexico City to be exact, and you know, moving to the United States and getting away from your culture and you know, losing your identity actually got me interested in more and more learning about, you know, where I came from, where all our people came from, and why certain things happened. So history has been a passion of mine, and I'm actually focused on the revolutions of Latin America, specifically the two Cuban revolutions and the Mexican, obviously, from my country. But I think it was finding the identity that I've, you know, I started feeling like I was losing with so many, living more years in the U.S. than I did in my own country. So that's what drove me.
Yeah. And do you think, so this is mostly a show that focuses on activism and on organizing. What do you think the role of academics and historians specifically is in kind of like political work more generally?
I think it's very important to understand, you know, to, when you're running an activist campaign or, you know, you're trying to activate people to do certain things or, you know, a call to action or anything, you know, having perspectives of what's happened before and how movements worked and, you know, how they were successful, I think it gives people, you know, an insight as to certain things they can do and certain things I think they can avoid, obviously. It's a learning process. In Mexico, you know, there's a guy by the he's actually very controversial because he's the son of President Carlos Salinas, and he talks about, you know, political activists and actually gathering the people because it's so important to have active people and being part of their civil action and civil rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously, especially when you're to the point of a full-blown revolution, as in what you're studying. So,
right. Even then, I mean, in revolutions, obviously, you know, it's the masses of the people actually revolting against oppression and the government as usual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess since the original idea that I reached out to you around was Venezuela, I'm really interested as a media person in the media coverage of everything that's happened in the last, say, 2 years.
Okay.
From the imposition of sanctions to the
right
overthrow, basically the installation. Yeah. The installation of Guaido. I'm assuming that listeners, you know, follow the news to a basic extent, but, do you think you could give like a condensed summary
of what's been going on
in
Venezuela?
Yeah.
So, you know, after Hugo Chavez's reign for, you know, 2 decades, we know he gets sick and he passes the reins over to Maduro, who was his, you know, his head of state. And what really affected, I think, the Maduro's, you know, time has been obviously the oil prices plummeting, you know, so low to, you know, more than 50% from what it used to be when Chavez had. So besides that, I think the corruption, the level of corruption that he's taken as, you know, as part of his regime has been bad. So not only did the oil prices affect what happened to him, but also, you know, the corruption where he was using special interests for people that he knew to have a different currency rate than the populist people. So with all that being said, and obviously U.S. interests on oil, you know, they installed Guaido there. And then so that's what's been happening right now. And the coverage is obviously always negative against the Maduro and Chavez regime because they're really far leftist, you know, aligned with Fidel Castro, where in especially North America and U.S. media coverage, that's something we can't align with because we've had bad experiences with the communist countries. So I think that obviously the media coverage does their job at reporting, what interests them, but they do leave certain things out where, we don't want to hear, or we might not want to hear that are actually happening. So,
Yeah, I was reading, and I'll share the link on the podcast notes, but an article that Mark Cook wrote on FAIR, the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting Center.
Right.
And he was living in Caracas at the time and was seeing all these reports from the U.S. that, there's no medicine on shelves and this and that. And he went out to a bunch of different pharmacies
and took photos.
There is
medicine. And there's actually, obviously both extremes are, I think, exaggerated a bit on certain things. Mm-hmm. Maduro's government will claim that there's only been about 1 million people that have actually fled to neighboring countries, where we're getting reports of 3 million. Well, obviously, regardless, even if we split it in the middle, it's a terrible thing, and we know that they're suffering, their economy suffering due to the oil prices. But I think the U.S. sanctions have really affected that as well, because we know they have accounts and tons of monies frozen that they could actually use. I mean, hopefully for the good of their people.
Yeah. And I think one of the main issues with the presentation of the coverage is people are expected to either support what the U.S. and allies have done in installing someone else or completely support everything that the Maduro government
has done. Oh, yeah. It seems to be very either left or right, and I think that's a huge problem with even today's politics in the U.S. that, we can't find the middle ground where people can actually come together and, make conversations of disagreements. It's either left or right. And so that's caused a very unstable situation in Venezuela. I know that there's corruption and there's always been humanitarian abuse in some sort of, communist or really far left countries. But I think a lot has to do with the lack of support that some new countries get or leftist countries get from, these huge economic powers or imperialist countries that could actually some way work with them. I think the lack of support of that is what leads to these kind of, we saw it in Cuba, after Fidel took over.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, and also just again and again, being put in the position of rebuilding or being on the defensive whether it's from U.S. imperialism directly or indirectly, so with, sanctions and everything like that. So I wonder if you can talk about that, about this current coup. I mean, would you call it a coup in Venezuela? Is that is that fair to say?
It's not a coup realistically, but they basically installed Guaido there, who's, supported obviously by the U.S. because and I do think a lot of it has to do with special interest again, because, we know the number one supplier of oil reserves is Venezuela in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, far more than even Saudi Arabia. So, if we disregard the fact that there's special interest there, then we wouldn't, I think that's why the U.S. is so involved. Mm-hmm. More than really the humanitarian rights and, the activists, which I think, yes, we need humanitarian activists. We need them to have food. We need them to have aid. But if you ask me, I think the interest is more special than humanitarian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how, I guess just over the whole region, how has the issue of resources played into the U.S.'s kind of selective role place to place?
So basically, are we talking about South America or Central America or just in general, all Latin America?
I say just in general, all Latin America, but I know it's different.
Yeah, I think it always has been special interest. I mean, the U.S., installed the Monroe Doctrine, and, that's basically where he's like, America is for the Americas, and we're going to do what we can to help each other out. And, we can go even further to the good neighbor policies and everything. But I think we can't forget that. The reason why, for instance, the U.S. goes to war with Spain is to gain control of Cuba. Now, during that time in the 1890s, Cuba was one of the richest ports, you know, coming from the Americas to Europe. And they know, you know, that the sugar that they were producing was very important. So having control of a port like that, even though they were actually telling them that they were giving them independence, you know, they knew it was important. So special interest. And we saw a large number of American companies starting out growth in Cuba. Then we go to Central America, Nicaragua, and, you know, all the banana plantations. And, you know, if we can refer to the banana wars, mm-hmm. we know that, you know, I can think of the company Chiquita Banana, mm-hmm. right? Who large growth, U.S. special interest, but it was there. And there's where we saw a lot of coups where, you know, U.S. military trained or U.S. backed military leaders would come in. Defeat this leftist governments like Sandino's, you know, government who was assassinated by Somoza, trained and backed by the U.S. government. So mm-hmm. I have always seen, obviously, in imperialist countries did that with the, you know, with the Americas as well. So, you know, this is a trend that, you know, they learned from imperialist countries, but it has caused economic instability, and it's now why we have certain things like crisis at the border. Like, you know, Venezuela struggling for food and medicine when, you know, they're sanctioned. So, you know, mm-hmm. that's, I would say that, I mean, we can dive into the details, but that's how I would say the broad perspective is.
Yeah. And what do you think as someone who's, you know, dedicated the last couple of years to really studying this at a deep level, what do you think some of the biggest misconceptions are around history of, say, Central America, right. just as an example, because that's what we were just talking about?
I think the largest misconceptions is that the leftist military dictatorships were actually, you know, as bad as they seem. One, you know, as, you know, they abuse the people. And we see them, at least in some parts of our countries, we see them as people who were given back the country, the people, you know, who they were from. And, you know, taking all these big powers out of the country, like Cuba did when Fidel takes over and he nationalizes every company, and, you know, and he kicks the U.S. out. So that's a misconception that I think in Latin America we don't have as much. I mean, we can go from Chile, Allende, large support. Fidel, even though, you know, in the end he became corrupt, he's known for being, you know, evil. But if you study everything that went around him during his reign, I would be paranoid too that everybody wanted to kill me because of the U.S. constantly attacking him. Mm-hmm. So I think that when we think of communism in Latin America, it is more accepting than when we think of it in the U.S. Because if you think of Thomas More and it's utopia, mm-hmm. what is utopia? We talked about a communist society. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's more accepted like that because there's poorer countries, so they know that they have to share more than when we live in a more powerful capitalist society where everybody thinks they can get to the top. I think everybody more people in Latin America accept the fact that, you know, they're not going to move up the social classes. Mm-hmm. So,
which really, that's a really efficient way to explain it that kind of points right to why the U.S. can't seem to leave these countries alone, especially over the 20th century since the Cold War, you know, long before that. But somewhere like Venezuela with the largest oil reserve in the world, I'm sure that stings on some level to have all that oil being controlled by a socialist to communist government.
Yes. I think, like I said, I mean, we know that, you know, we go to countries where other countries are, you know, we go back to the Soviet Union, you know, where there was, you know, abuse on humanitarian rights. And in some ways, Fidel did abuse some humans, some of their rights. But in reality, I think all the revolutions, or at least all the leftist movements, were always from the poor, from people trying to get their country back, you know, from stolen lands, stolen resources, you know, being abused by labor. I mean, and so when they align with Fidel, or, you know, when Fidel aligned with, I'm drawing a blank now, with the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. you know, he was seen as evil when he just needed, he was looking for economic backup more than anything, I believe, and he failed him as well. So there mm-hmm. goes Cuba.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess what specifically, I think specifically regarding Cuba, since it's so close mm-hmm. to the U.S., people maybe are both more and less familiar with the U.S. relationship with Cuba. But how would you say it's like a case study for the ways the U.S. has interacted with other countries?
I think, in many ways, we can relate the sanctions, you know, on oil and on the trades and, you know, using the monies from Venezuela for exports and everything. It's the same thing they did with the embargo with Cuba, you know, where they cut off a large percentage of their income with their tobacco, which we knew was a large percentage of their economy. And so it affected them the same way. And obviously Cuba, again, started lacking resources. Cuba, like Venezuela, gave a lot of, still gives, you know, a lot of, for instance, free education. Mm-hmm. You know, Cuba is one of the countries in all Americas that exports more doctors to the world. Mm. And we're talking about one of the poorest islands. So, you know, they still have a free education. Sure, they struggle giving people food and, you know, housing. But it's because they lack these resources due to an embargo, due to, you know, special interests trying to gain more percentage of their, you know, of the those economic funds mm-hmm. than actually sharing it with the people. So I think it's very similar in many ways to what happened in Cuba after Fidel takes leadership than when Hugo Chavez takes leadership and obviously aligns with the leftist, you know, mm-hmm. or some, you know, Marxists, think mm-hmm. of the Marxist movements.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then it seems like with Cuba and then with Venezuela as well, either the embargo or the sanctions in this case are put on and then, you know, the country suffers and then the U.S. points to the country suffering and says, like, look, see, they can't even
right. They
take
can't
care
even
of their
exactly.
people.
So they can't even feed their people. They you know, all the help they're trying to provide, they can't even afford it. Well, you know, when you yourself are affecting that, because mm-hmm. it does directly affect, you know, all the funds they cut off, you know, due to the sanctions. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, Maduro may not have been like Chavez, because I think at least if you look at the social structure that he built and, you know, like the social policies, and he built a lot of schools. You know, he did some work in the social area in the I'm drawing a blank here, in the social services, where it really, Venezuela was doing great, you mm-hmm. know, until, like we said, you know, we know oil prices plummet, and then, you know, he's gone, and then Maduro takes over and makes up this new currency for his mm-hmm. him and his buddies, you know. So it's very easy to blame, you know, the dictators, but it's you know, sometimes it's hard to accept that, you know, maybe as an American or as, you know, living in the U.S. to accept that we have a lot to do with why they're suffering. Mm-hmm. So, and that's reality. It's truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis. I'm talking with Ivan Torres. He's a scholar locally at Eastern, doing a master's in history with a focus on Latin American revolutions. And that's what we're talking about today. I thought you mentioned this in your introduction, but I'm really interested in just in general and like connecting the dots for people and helping to do that. And you mentioned the border, the U.S.-Mexico border,
right?
Which has kind of been a political focus for a long time. But since Trump has taken power in the U.S., it's definitely accelerated and been at the forefront of people's consciousness. So how did we get there?
Well, so, I mean, we obviously know that we can start talking about, again, historically, you know, I think we mentioned the banana wars. And so, you know, the special interest of the U.S. to have companies there, you know, to exploit the funds and the labor of Central America was very useful. Again, we have the leftist movements in countries like Guatemala. We have the leftist movement in countries like Nicaragua, where, you know, we talked about, I think, people are familiar with the term the Contras, right? Mm-hmm. Which were trained by the U.S. to defeat the leftist government and gain back their, you know, their companies and obviously their special interests for funds. So through these wars and through these military coups and constant war, you know, civil war, there's still civil war. Guerrilla warfare is the, you know, the common thing now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these small groups of people fighting for their lands back. They want, you know, they want their government back. And so all this economic instability and all this, like, you know, war and everything, it's going to cause issues, you know. So basically all this economic stability they've caused throughout decades of wars, people are starving, people are poorer, you know, and so they have to go somewhere to survive, you know, and they know that the only place that maybe they might have a possibility will be north, which is Mexico to start off. And, you know, the social racism in Latin America is unfortunately is true, but it's, you know, it's sad, but it's true. So, you know, especially indigenous people moving into Mexico have always been a problem, even with our own people. You know, there's always this social class where they don't accept them and, you know, they discriminate them. And so then they have to move up north even more to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think of all that U.S. has done to support these military coups, you know, and to cause all this instability, both social and economic in Central America, they've caused a huge, like, vacuum to slowly start, you know, for people to flee somewhere and look for stability. And, like, you know, I mean, for us, it's easy to say because we live here, but, you know, when these parents are, their kids are starving, they have no, you know, no homes, they have nowhere to go, they're gonna do whatever they can to survive, or at least they try, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. many of them actually die crossing the border, mm-hmm. so.
And no one wants to leave home.
No.
Just to leave home, particularly no. people who are indigenous and who are from
right.
a culture that's about being connected to your land.
Yes.
That you're from.
And I think, you know, I mean, like I said, that's what drove my passion into Latin American revolutionary history, is because even though I love living in the U.S., my country will always be, you know, my home. And whenever I go to Mexico City, there's nowhere else where I feel like home when I'm, like when I'm there. And I think, you know, no one wants to leave their country, you know. But if we had, you know, we had the Great Depression, you know, if that's basically what they're living through. They've been living through a Great Depression for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you know, eventually they start, we know chain migration, their friends move, they know they're doing good. Well, I have a kid, I can't feed him. Where am I going to go? I'm going to go north.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I know there's an issue with immigration. There's also an issue with what the U.S. has done with, for instance, criminals. So, for instance, I'm pretty sure you're familiar with the MS-13 gang,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
That started in California. But, you know, through the mass deportation of MS-13 members back to El Salvador, now that became a problem in El Salvador. And now that's an entity that controls much of what happens in El Salvador, mm-hmm. sadly.
So. I did not realize that. They started in California.
Oh, MS-13 started in California,
and
yes.
So then they were deported, because it's always presented as this problem. It's this threat
right.
that's
oh,
coming.
Oh, MS-13 is coming. No,
not a threat that's already been here.
Yeah, so MS-13 was here. They're deported back to El Salvador, you know, and eventually the jail cells and the corruption in the jail system in Latin America is amazingly terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can tell you, I read a few articles in a book on the incarceration of Mexico, and no, this is true. Anybody that goes to jail for 1 to 5 years, they're about 75% of them don't actually see a jury. They get sentenced in the prosecutor. So when they're basically they jailed, the next day or two they'll be sentenced. They never see a hearing. They never see a trial. They never see a jury.
Wow.
That's
yeah.
It's troublesome.
Mm-hmm.
And so, obviously, you know, you can buy out judges much easier than you can in the U.S., I'm mm-hmm. sure. And the mass incarceration of MS-13 members led to them, you know, eventually getting out, getting control of what was, you know, the slums there, or, you know, the more poorer areas, to do whatever they could to get funds because the government was failing them. And now it's a huge problem. But now we're thinking, like you said, we know that it's a problem. We think it's coming here.
Mm-hmm.
When actually it's a circle.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, and then to use that brush, and it's just been gross. I mean, how people in leadership in this country have used that broad brush to say that everyone coming across the border is maybe a criminal, you know, this fear mongering. And it seems like it's maybe just the next wave of using fear to keep average everyday people in the Americas from connecting with each other and identifying like as just working people trying to survive.
Right.
No, who are maybe speaking a different language across a different border. But yeah, it seems like it's gone from, you know, scary communists to just scary criminals.
Scary, yeah.
You know?
I mean, yeah, the word immigration, you know, has a lot of negative connotations nowadays, especially when it's south of the border.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if we study, there's a lot of people that are here with overstayed visas. You know, I'm not sure what the percentage is now, but I remember reading an article where 20% of the people with you know, undocumented were actually overstayed visas, and it wasn't just from South America, mm-hmm. Latin America. It was from Europe. It was from, mm-hmm. you know, Canada.
A lot of from Canada. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I bet you that we don't think of, you know, we probably won't have that fear connotation if we know, hey, you know, I know a couple of friends that are Canadian and, you know, they're here and undocumented. It won't be the same effect as if you're talking about Latin American, mm-hmm. or, you know, especially Central American people moving to the U.S. undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different, and obviously a lot of it has to do with racial disparities, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah. I also remember, you know, right after the Trump election, a ton of Americans kind of half joking, like white Americans, about how they're going to have to go move to Canada. And it's just like, well, why are you allowed to do that, you know?
Right.
When really, like, your day-to-day conditions are nowhere close to.
Yeah, I know. I think we deal with many problems that we think are major. Like you said, like, oh my God, Trump's elected. And sure, I mean, even in my home, mm-hmm. I I'm not a Trump supporter, or it was a tough day to you know, wake up to that or go to sleep to that, actually. Mm-hmm. But in no way do we face the issues of actual people that are, you know, especially in Latin America. I mean, we can talk about Venezuela. You know, there is a crisis. We know there's a crisis. It might not be as the media paints it, but there is a crisis there. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mexico, my own country, has been under crisis for decades, mm-hmm. you know. So we do live privileges of saying, oh, I don't like my president, I'm going to move to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're not saying, oh, I have nothing to eat. Like, I have no job, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have no opportunities where we do here, I'm going to move to Canada. So mm-hmm. yeah, you're right. It is completely different.
Yeah. So what do you think, you know, we're dealing with the fallout from these years and years and years of this bad relationship, basically, exploitation, imperialism, et cetera. What do you think we can learn from it? Like, what do you think is the best possible political direction for
the U.S.
Mm-hmm, for the U.S. as in regards to Latin America?
I think the proper involvement with, for instance, with labor relations, where, you know, we know there's been many American companies still in Mexico that, you know, exploit the, you know, their labor industry because it's so cheap. I think the best way to go is to try to meet in the, you know, like I said, find the middle ground where we can work with even countries like Venezuela, who, even if they're under a leftist dictatorship, but, you know, if they're providing free healthcare, they're providing free education, you know, they're providing many things that we can't provide, then, you know, finding a middle ground where we can work with them, where, you know, it won't disturb the peace, I think would be the best way. But like I said, the problem is where we have a fear of immigration, right? We know that, but we have a fear of communist economies or communist countries, because, you know, we've learned that, you know, they could be bad for a capitalist society more than really the political part. Because if we have a communist country, you know, that Venezuela controls, let's say Venezuela controls all their exports, all their oil, but they're sharing it more with people, not special interests, doesn't get that large of a cut. So, you know, it's, I mean, I think it's as simple as just knowing mm-hmm. that we have to find a way where special interest doesn't get as involved in politics, and where there's more, you know, actual policies that help the people.
Mm-hmm. And I realized, you know, we've talked about some of the leftist governments that have been targeted by the U.S., but just last month, the U.S. brought, you know, the White House brought Bolsonaro up. And,
correct.
You know, Trump and Bolsonaro, who's been elected while his main opponent was jailed in Brazil, they were very chummy on TV.
Yes.
Talking about how Trump now wants to invite Brazil into NATO, which I think is a long shot. But can you speak to kind of some of the far right developments that have happened in countries like Brazil, maybe Colombia, other places where things have swung the other direction?
Right. I think a lot of the far right movements obviously have to do, like I said, with a belief in the capitalist society, maybe in a belief in that that we look at other countries like the U.S., especially that, you know, are more economically stable, we know, with more of a right-controlled government, you know, where there's more control over, you know, special interests, where the large companies control, you know, what's being sold and what's being bought and all the commerce in countries. And I think in Latin America, the problem was, like I said, is the lack of, when, you know, all these new countries happened in, what, 1800s, you know, we can talk, like, early to mid-1800s, all the independences happened, and we have new countries. The lack of aid, obviously, was always a trouble, you know, and they've always been emerging economies, where the U.S. is a completely different story, you know. They came and they conquered a land where there were small pockets of indigenous people, not as large civilizations, you know, so they took over the identity, where in Brazil and Latin America, you know, the identity wasn't, it was mixed, it was more mixed. So eventually all this economic issue and, you know, the social structure continues. But since they've always been, you know, taken advantage and oppressed by, you know, more leftist or more centralized, now they're like, you know, well, maybe we'll go with the right now. Mm. Maybe it'll be something good. So I think the lack of funds and the lack of success that, you know, leftists or centralized countries have had are starting to see, hey, maybe we need to change things around. So I think maybe they're starting to change the ideology.
Mm-hmm. Which I guess is really similar in some ways to how it's been everywhere, with whether overt fascism or just far right extreme governments. It tends to be disenfranchised working people who think, Maybe this is who will take
right.
care of us.
Exactly.
You know?
Yes, exactly. You know, maybe these guys, maybe they'll have more power. They'll be backed by bigger entities. Maybe mm-hmm. they will change things for us, you know, and we'll just have to see what happens in Brazil. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
Brazil, the economic structure, and, you know, it's bad there too. You know, mm-hmm. you talk about Venezuela, about Brazil, they're, it's pretty tough there.
And the violence, too, the openness of the violence, to have someone who was part of the military dictatorship saying, you know,
right.
we didn't jail enough of our opponents, we didn't kill enough of our opponents, and then being elected is just kind of...
Yeah, it's like Rios Montt in Guatemala when he was, you know, when he reigned. I mean, he literally on TV would say, you know, if you speak against us, we're going to assassinate you, we're going to execute you. And I mean, mm-hmm. that's the far right. And he was an evangelist, you know, mm-hmm. super Christian person. But here he is talking about how he's going to execute anyone mm-hmm. who speaks against him.
Mm-hmm. And doing it.
Oh, yeah, he did. He sure mm-hmm. did. Yeah, it was.
Did not just say it.
I'm trying to think of the number of people that died during his reign, but it mm-hmm. was.
I mean, it's millions.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was mm-hmm. genocide, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I think, like I said, I think the lack of success of Latin American countries due to the lack of economic stability, I think it's changing the ideology of some people to say, you know what, like, we've been struggling with, you know, centralized or leftist country, military, you know, with leftist governments. Let's see if, you know, maybe the right mm-hmm. will actually give us something that, you know, we can actually live on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess just in these last few minutes that we have, what would you say? I mean, I think solidarity is really important, and finding ways to actually, like, take action in solidarity. What do you think for people who live in the U.S., whether they were born here or not, what are some things that people can do just to show solidarity either with immigrants who are fleeing this kind of instability or with people who are trying to find self-determination in their countries?
I think they need to start start reading the correct text. Maybe start reading other sources other than, you know, what's written here. I mean, nowadays we can find a lot of books that are translated, you know, and I think listening or hearing or reading or seeing the other country's perspective and why maybe there was a large following of Chavez, why there was a large following of Fidel, right? Mm-hmm. Understanding that perspective might give them a better understanding as to why, you know, why things happen and then why people are fleeing and leaving, you know, leaving their country because they can't live there, you know?
Yeah.
So I think being better informed of other sources other than our own is huge. At least it helped me understand mm-hmm. many things, you know, that I might have been ignorant or unaware of.
Yeah. What are some either outlets or like specific books? What would you say are good starting points for people? No pressure to like bust out a whole reading list, but.
I read a lot of, obviously a lot of Cuban and Mexican authors, but I would say, for instance, one author that I really, really like and I recommend, and we can just start with this list because he's written about most Latin American countries, is Taibo II. And so he has a list of about 23 books that he's published all over Latin America. I would just recommend to start with him. Very good reporter, very in detail. He takes his time writing his books. And he's one that I read the most and I really, really respect. So it's Ignacio Taibo. And his books are already translated in English. So, yeah.
Sweet. So no excuse.
Yeah. No. Yep. It's easy to find them online everywhere. He's very popular in Latin America. You know, he's a history professor at the University in Mexico. So he's excellent. And like I said, he's published in Paraguay. He's published in Chile, Argentina. So
cool.
Just start with him. And then that way, you know, you get a little respect. From there, you can look at his sources and look at mm-hmm. other stuff. But Taibo II, for sure.
Cool. I'll post some links when I post the podcast, which will go up tonight. If people don't follow the podcast, you can search Praxis Radio on iTunes, on Google Play, anywhere like that. Or you can go directly to soundcloud.com/Praxis Radio, PraxisRadio. Do you have anything else you want to add? Anything else you want to make sure people know, think more about through their night?
No, I mean, I think, you know, like it was a great... I love conversations like this, you know, and I think that, like I said, it's important to know that even though some people like Fidel Castro or Chavez were known as dictators or everything, they actually gave their people something that no one else had given them. You know, they gave them a good education. They, you know, they gave them good health care, and that goes a long ways. As we know, you know, education is very necessary, mm-hmm. or else we'll end up where we're at now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, anytime. Welcome back.
All right.
Yeah. If you're just joining us at the end of this chunk of the show, I've been talking with Ivan Torres. He's a local scholar, master student at Eastern, focusing on Latin American revolutions. I'm going to take a quick break. And when I get back, we'll be talking about the May Day March on Wednesday, which is also focused on immigration. So stay tuned. And we'll be right back.
Triste se oye la lluvia en los techos de cartón. Qué triste vive mi gente en las casas de cartón. Viene bajando el obrero casi arrastrando sus pasos por el peso del sufrir.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to Praxis. Before the break, I was on with Ivan Torres. He says to tell his wife, Isabel, he loves her. He forgot, but he does. He just left. And now I'm on the phone with Martin. He's helping organize the May Day March. Can you hear me out there?
Yeah. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Do you mind just introducing yourself for folks and then talking a little bit about this march on Wednesday?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Martin. I'm one of the members at the Spokane Animal Rights Coalition. And so May Day, it's an event that is done worldwide, but nationwide, and mostly on the west side. It's a day to honor and represent low-income workers and families that have to work really hard to make sure that they can have a good life, as well as it's a day to fight for immigrant rights. And so that's a day for us to stand in solidarity and raise our voices to make sure that our families are going to be safe and secure here in Spokane.
Great. So if people want to go, where will they find the march, and what should they be prepared for?
Yeah, so we have a Facebook event. If you put May Day and Spokane, we should be able to pop up. We have all the information there, but basically we'll be starting at 4 p.m. at Riverfront Park, and then we'll have a couple speakers as well as a couple performers, and from there we'll do a march right after. And yeah, it's really about just showing solidarity and making sure that our message goes through to Spokane, that immigrant and refugee communities and low-income communities are welcome, and they're going to be supported.
Yeah. So I guess just to back up a little bit, what's your story, and what I guess what's your tie to wanting to work on workers' issues and immigrant issues and immigrant workers' issues?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to really anything that has to do with low income or immigration issues, it's very it's very direct to me. I'm a DACA recipient, so I've been in the movement for the last 7 years, making sure that I raise my voice for the people that can't. I use my worker's permit to really highlight that immigrants' lives are important in our community. And, you know, Spokane, especially here in Spokane, I've been living in Spokane for the last 5 years. I came to Cheney to go to Eastern Washington University. And so Spokane is changing, and there's a lot of immigrant communities coming here, and a lot of people just showing up. And it's really important that we set a structure and a base to welcome those families. And so that's a little bit about me and why I'm so passionate about this work. And also, you know, again, May Day is a platform where not only Spokane, but all over California, the west side in Seattle always has a May Day march. So it's a day where really everybody stands in solidarity, and we want to make sure that Spokane is part of that as well.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've talked about immigration on the show quite a lot, and obviously it's a constant topic in political discourse right now. What would you say are some of the main issues locally that people should be more aware of that are facing this growing?
Directly here in Spokane, there's a couple things going on, especially in the city of Spokane. To start off, the Greyhound station, I'm pretty sure you've talked about this a lot, is welcoming Customs and Border Patrol agents into their private business so that they can do unwarranted searches. So at this point, we've heard of Customs and Border Patrol agents getting into the bus with submachine guns, asking for status for folks, and really just kind of using stereotypical techniques to look for immigrants or refugees. So that's one very direct fact that's going on in Spokane. And then the other one is, and a lot of folks don't know about this, is that our Spokane County Jail actually has an intergovernmental service contract that they get paid $80 per head. So basically, they get $80 per night that they can pick somebody who is an undocumented person up. And so they're monetizing our people. And so, and this isn't just in Spokane, but we also have this in Yakima. We have this in Ephrata. And so right now, the great thing is that we have a legislation that just passed, Keep Washington Working, that is going to be fighting that, that contract to be ended. But it's still going to be in effect for the next year or two. And so it's important that we let our county representatives and our local representatives know that it isn't okay to keep putting targets on people's backs, and that we have to make sure that our city is going to be safe for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Even as they're complaining that there's not enough room in the jail, they're making room for ICE and for federal customs to use jail beds, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't have the exact numbers, but yeah, that's one of their priorities in the jail. Again, they're making money off of that, which they shouldn't. It's almost, I mean, it's ran like a public sector where, you know, they're making money off every person that they can get. And it doesn't end there. Again, you know, when they pick up somebody in Spokane, they get money in Yakima as well. And that goes all around the eastern side of the state. And one of the things is really to make sure that our city ordinance that just, to make sure that immigrants and refugees, to make sure that they have warrants and that they're using their protocols, for that to actually be taken care of in our city, as it has not gone through because of the mayor not supporting the ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's really, May Day is going to be that day for us to share our stories, talk about that's going on in Spokane.
Great. And what do you think? I mean, obviously, people should show up to the march if they want to, you know, show their solidarity, if they want to support immigrant communities and working communities here in town. What else would you say? What are a couple of the main things that people can do to show up for immigrants and refugees here in Spokane?
Definitely. Making sure, you know, to kind of, I would say number one is really get to know where are some organizations that are helping out these communities if you want to help further than just going to the march. And a lot of those organizations that are already in solidarity and refugee families are going to be there on May Day. So that'll be a day where folks can meet new community. But yeah, you know, really getting to connect with folks there, understanding the issues is going to be important. I think that the more we know what is happening here in Spokane, the more we can talk about it and the more that we can actually get done. And so, yeah, you know, I would say that definitely May Day isn't just about a day for us to raise our voices, but it's also a day to learn and educate ourselves on what's going on and what are the things that are happening. And I think on that day, you know, for folks that are questioning, like, what is it something that I can do? I think that day maybe a spot where it can open doors and knowing what to do to help families around the city of Spokane.
Awesome. Is there anything else you want to add that you want to let listeners know about? Be sure to mention.
I really hope to see everyone there. Thank y'all so much for inviting me and, yeah, let's have a great May Day March y la lucha sigue.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you for joining me. And yeah, I'll see you on Wednesday.
Awesome. Sounds great. Have a great day.
Awesome. And if you're just joining us, that was Martine. He's one of the organizers of the May Day March, which you can join by showing up at Riverfront Park at 4 p.m. There'll be a rally with speakers, I believe, near the clock tower. I did already share that Facebook event on my Facebook page at facebook.com/PraxisRadio, PraxisRadio. And then the march will continue from that location. So Again, all of that's online. If you missed any part of the show, the interview with Yvonne, anything else, you can find the entire podcast posted later on today. You can find that link by going to kyrs.org, navigating to shows and then Praxis, or you can go directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio. If you ever have questions about the show or have an idea for someone you're dying to hear me interview, you can email me at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, at kyrs.org. I'll be back next week with a new show, hopefully lots of great interviews captured at said May Day March. So until then, keep up the fight, and we'll be back next week. Democracy Now! Is up next.